Warning, this podcast details firsthand accounts of graphic crime, as well as deeply disturbing emotional profiles, and may not be suitable for all listeners. Please proceed with caution.
Glasses Manifesto.
The second crime occurred in October of 76. That was in Flushing, Queens. About 1:30 in the morning. Now, I look back at it now and say I'm glad nobody was killed, but at that time, I was angry because I saw that as a failure, you know. It made me look like a failure that I failed at doing it.
A Molasses Manifesto production brought to you by Audio Up. You're listening to Killer Tape, true crime podcast where killers and hardcore criminals tell their own story in their own words. I'm your host, documentary filmmaker Bill Badgley. Joining me is veteran prison reporter Jack Jones. This is Killer Tape, Season 1, David Berkowitz, a.k.a. Son of Sam.
I hope you die.
He confessed to being the 44 killer, ordered by a voice speaking through a neighbor's dog, carry out his bloody outrages against young pretty women.
I snuck up on him and shot him.
Berkowitz planned to use the revolver again and again until he felt police were getting close.
I wanted to help people. I wanted to be important to somebody, you understand?
David Berkowitz, 24 years old, found himself surrounded by police. Well, he said, you got me.
And now the need for a story, if not for anybody else, for myself.
Police say those words ended the biggest manhunt in New York City history.
I should have spent my whole life here for what I've done.
Episode 11, Failing at Everything. Act 1, Everything is Different Now. In the fall of 1976, at the tender age of 23, David Berkowitz, monumentally unable to deal with the increasingly complex feelings he had always had, first for his adoptive mother Pearl, later for his birth mother Betty Falco, and then ultimately for every woman to whom he had ever been attracted or even had a brief interaction with, had begun to silently and viciously lash out in a one-man war against every single woman on the planet. A war that sadly had begun to take on casualties. When, on July 29th, 1976, David Berkowitz shot down Jody Valenti and Donna Loria in cold blood, killing Donna, officially making him a murderer. When he did that, when he lifted the gun and fired it, he translated into action what he had previously only fantasized about, and in doing so, ran so far beyond the confrontation point between himself and his problems that he was now hiding again, riddled with fear and backed into a corner of his own making. A corner he felt he could only shoot his way out of. Due to this, there was no longer any sort of conceivable resolution floating even hazily on the horizon. All that appeared in front of him now was a descending staircase into chaos and confusion. If only David Berkowitz had had the courage to face himself and confront his problems before they ballooned into an indecipherable mass he could only cower before, then maybe, just maybe, none of this would have happened. But he didn't, and it did. And when it did, David brought the entire world into a melodrama that heretofore had only included himself and three others: his adoptive mother Pearl, his adoptive father Nat, and his birth mother Betty Falco. Because, up until the moment of the first attack, on Christmas Eve, 1975, when David stabbed 15-year-old Michelle Foreman with a hunting knife, David's story was a story comprised of zero reality-based plot points. It was a story that had largely taken place in David's own mind. And it started in childhood, after his adoptive mother Pearl tucked him in at night saying, quote, "Angels be with you." David Berkowitz had developed the belief that angels were watching his every deed, reporting back to a vengeful God his every misstep. After being hit by a car, he developed a fascination with death. When his adoptive parents told him his natural mother had died in childbirth, as they had been instructed, a 5-year-old David began labeling himself a murderer and feared his bereaved father was looking to find him and kill him. At 14, he had labeled himself murderer once again when he assumed the guilt over the death of his adoptive mother, Pearl, after she succumbed to her third bout with cancer. In high school, believing himself to be a murderer of not one, but two women, he began to accumulate negative experiences with the young women in his peer group, adding them, one by one, to the growing tally of negative associations he had with women. In the military, he developed an affinity for weaponry and began to connect them to his feelings of worthlessness and frustration. Before being discharged, he was introduced to Christianity, and along with it, the concept that it was the devil, not him, who was to blame for his evil thoughts and deeds. Then finally, after finding out his birth mother was alive, he was filled with an all-consuming anger that he had been lied to. And as a result, David Berkowitz had decided to kill. And so it was that the narrative that had led David to murder was a narrative that operated almost entirely in his own mind. It was a story in which nothing had ever actually really happened. The elements painfully constructed to make him a murderer had been constructed out of thin air, comprised of nothing but empty space and ideas penned entirely by his own hand. There never was, or ever had been, any other author. David Berkowitz had simply made the whole thing up. Everything he had ever felt or ever thought, based on miscalculations and distorted perceptions fabricated by fear, then mass-produced in his own mind. Now it was all too real. He had indulged his pain and believed in his own self-righteous indignation, so much so that it had taken shape, stood up, and walked out the door. Now the cops were involved. Now, although slowly at first, the entire world would be involved, and the devastating effects of David's behavior forever and for all time. David Berkowitz had attacked and murdered a young woman. And in the fall of 1976, as the saga played out in real time, he was gearing up to do it again. The duality that had always gone on secretly inside him had now been exploited. It had left his mind and entered the world through the barrel of a gun for all to see. David Berkowitz was now officially two men. One, an oafish nobody with a day job and a silly grin, who occasionally made awkward comments and was generally ignored by everyone. The other, a silent killer with a .44. Both men wore the same shoes, lived in the same apartment, and occupied the same mind, manifesting a duplicity, the reverberations of which were about to shake the whole machine apart. There was now a ticking time clock on the whole mess. One day it was going to end, and it was just a matter of time, a matter of what would happen and who would die before it did. David Berkowitz was approximately 1 year out from being incarcerated for the murder of 6 and the injury of 10, culminating in perhaps the most infamous string of murders to ever occur in the 20th century. And so it was, in March of 1980, within the walls of Attica Prison, just 2 years after the murders, that our co-host, investigative journalist Jack Jones, sat across from David, attempting to construct a puzzle backwards, cutting apart the clouds from the skyline, forming them back to their individual pieces in order to see how they fit together, how they were constructed. And in order to do that, he had to be very careful.
I was aware throughout our times together that I had to be on friendly terms with him. This wasn't just one guy talking to another one about something he had done. I had to keep in mind that he was a specimen. He was a rare, dangerous creature that I somehow had been the one chosen to sit down with face to face and try to unravel the complex puzzle of not just why he did what he did, but why other people kill for the fun of killing. I felt like I was doing some weird form of psychic brain surgery, and I had to choose my tools, which were words, very carefully. Not murders, but crimes, and that sort of thing. And that also kept me from any risk of thinking that although he was altogether affable with me virtually the entire time we were doing these interviews over a period of months, for thinking that he could in any way become a, quote, friend or someone other than a specimen who needed to be talked to in the most competent way possible to unlock, in the best of all possible worlds, a key reason why people kill people they don't know and have no logical reason to want to kill.
Jack asks David about the events leading up to the second shooting.
The second crime occurred in October of 76. That was in Flushing, Queens, about 1:30 in the morning. The exact details, I think you'd have to research and check, you know. That'd be available almost any place.
In customary fashion, Berkowitz, reluctant to discuss the murders, would rather leave them unmentioned. Or when mentioned, divulge as little as possible. Jack, however, knows that the closer he gets to the quote-unquote crimes, the closer he will get to motive. So he moves the pieces deeper, past the facts, and into the emotions preceding the events, bouncing back and forth between the external events and the internal ones. Jack asks David why he waited 4 months between the first two attacks.
I guess I had to work myself up and psych myself up again to do this. I just began to, I guess, exaggerate in my own mind, you know, various problems I was having, things on my mind, feeling isolated, lonely, frustrated.
David Berkowitz was ruminating in his own toxic filth, going over everything again and again, all the ways in which he was right, carefully generating the pieces he would need to give himself the permission to do what he had already decided he would. As much as he had, geographically, turned down offers to escape New York City and return again and again to the center point of his own irritation, he had to, emotionally, keep returning to his own hatred as well. He had a compulsion to do that, a desire to cross the distance between two points. He wanted to kill, and yet he was also a human being, much like any of the rest of us. He was both of these things. So, he had to build a bridge that would connect the two, allowing him to bypass what goodness he had left inside himself, in order to go through with the actions he had already committed himself to in his own mind. Jack asks David how far he parked from the second attack.
About 3 short blocks. But I'd hope that you, not put in all the gory details, if possible, you know.
Backing away, David deflects, subtly moving away from his own guilt and toward his taxi driver, Indy, laying the groundwork to come out on top, a hero, sneakily, as always.
I don't understand that there was no one thing that led up to this, you know. People are apt to just find some, like one superficial reason and say, well, that was probably his motive, you know. They lack all these understandings. This wasn't the case at all. As I say, it's not important for them to understand the motive, like, about my crimes, but the fact is that my crimes are more commonplace than as originally thought. You see, this is the idea. And once they understand my crimes, the others will be easier to understand and possibly prevent. And this is what I hope you do, you know, to show how this relates to most types of random violence which occur all at high frequency all over the country, in high frequency.
It's you that can benefit from me. I'm the good guy here. I can help you. I hold the key to understanding why people kill. I am the one that can turn this around for all of us.
He felt uncomfortable if he had to think about the possible suffering that these people went through because of his, quote, crimes. And crimes, it's kind of a once-removed definition that works but doesn't quite get at the heart of wanton murder. Murder for no other reason than to make me feel temporarily better because I've made somebody else feel really horrible, and I've taken every dream away from them and every possibility for a complete life.
As they did in his childhood and throughout his entire life, one side of the duality is constantly feeding off and working off the other. And when they come together, someone gets hurt. And sometimes it's David.
And I remember one incident where we were discussing at that point the murderers and his retrospective on them. He grabbed the table between us, and his lips and jaw were moving, but nothing was coming out. His eyes kind of bulged. I swear he turned two different colors. His face became kind of reddish on one side, greenish on the other. And this went on for maybe 45 seconds, close to a full minute. And it seemed as though he was trying to get moisture in his mouth so that he could move his tongue. And I just thought, my God, all the body fluids in this guy are like drying up. And I was about ready to get up and walk to the door and outside and summon a guard. When he cleared his throat, came around, and I said, are you okay? He said, yeah, why? He had no concept that he had had some kind of seizure, which lasted long enough that I sat there feeling quite uncomfortable.
Duality rising to the surface and resulting in a physical reaction, the internal becoming external, once again, Berkowitz himself cannot handle the two sides coming together, even years later. Quote, when I was about to commit my crimes, I was cognizant of finally being able to pass that point in which human plays God. Does that sound strange? Sure, I was nervous. Why? Because I was about to commit the ultimate of crimes, taking another's life. This was a very traumatic event. End quote. Act 2. Rosemary Keenan and Carl De Niro. On the evening of October 23rd, 1976, after nervously pacing his apartment in a panic state for hours on end, David Berkowitz succeeded in working himself into quite a tiz. So much so that at 1:45 a.m., like a mad dog broke free from its tether, he picked up the bulldog, made sure it was loaded, and headed out the door. He was wearing clean underwear, dirty jeans, a striped shirt, and a denim jacket. Again, he drove south, but on this particular night, he did something different and got on the Whitestone Bridge and headed towards Queens. Leaving the Bronx in his rearview, David Berkowitz was moving out of the Co-op City, Pelham Bay area and into the rest of the city, just as he had when he was a boy taking off on his bike to explore his isolation. David's circle was beginning to widen. Once in Queens, he drove around aimlessly. That is, until he saw a red Volkswagen parked with what he thought were two young women inside. Having found what he was looking for, he parked his car, approached the Volkswagen, and opened fire. While squeezing off round after round into the little red car, he noticed something. One of the people he was firing at was a man. David Berkowitz had never attacked a man before. Still, he continued firing until the revolver was empty, at which point he, quote, stayed for a couple minutes watching, end quote. The two unfortunate souls in the car were Rosemary Keenan and Carl De Niro, and this was Berkowitz's first, but far from last, attack in Queens. Here's our series producer, Allison Baker.
It was a Saturday night, just past midnight, when Carl De Niro, a 6-foot-tall, 20-year-old good-looking guy with long brown hair, was hanging out at his local dive, the Taxapo Grill. Carl and his buddies were having a round of farewell drinks before Carl enlisted in the United States Air Force the following week. Carl was looking forward to his enlistment. It was an opportunity to propel his life forward without being stuck in a lifetime of dead-end jobs. Carl and his friends huddled around the table with their beers as the music ricocheted off the walls. Strangers in the Night by Sinatra played on the jukebox. Across the room, Carl spotted a familiar face by the dance floor. It was Rosemary Keenan, an 18-year-old student of Queens College and the daughter of Redmond Keenan, a 20-year-old veteran and detective of the NYPD. Carl recognized Rosemary from class and headed over to say hi. Carl sat down, and for the next 2 hours, the pair laughed and talked the night away. It was getting late when his friends saw that he was preoccupied, so they waved goodbye to him from a distance and exited the bar. Rosemary also sensed it was getting late. She looked at the time and saw it was 2:30 a.m., the same time her father had requested she be escorted home. Carl was happy to fulfill that request, so they left their drinks on the table exited the bar, and climbed into her red Volkswagen towards Rosemary's house. As they got closer to Rosemary's, they decided they were not quite ready to end the night and pulled over near the corner of 159th Street and 33rd Avenue, a quiet residential intersection lined with large, beautiful brick homes. The streets were quiet as Carl and Rosemary sat in the car talking, when out of nowhere, an explosion of glass erupted, seemingly from inside the car. Not knowing what had just happened, Carl screamed for Rosemary to start the car. Rosemary frantically began driving back towards the Texapo Grill. As she pulled into the parking lot, Carl swung the passenger door open and stumbled into the club covered in blood and collapsed. He had been shot in the back of the head. Carl was quickly taken to Queens Hospital, where he remained for the next 3 weeks. A metal plate was used to replace part of his skull. Rosemary was unharmed. As Carl was working on his recovery, he learned that he had been disqualified from service as a result of his injuries. His career in the Air Force over before it started. He began working at the Citibank on Wall Street as a security guard.
Quote, the second job was the De Niro Keenan one. Both of them were sitting in a red Volkswagen and making out. This was my second murder attempt with my .44. I had approached them from the rear of the car, walked up to the passenger side window, and opened fire. I was more frightened than they were. Only one bullet struck the young man, and he really wasn't the intended target. I had fired with one hand and wildly. Boy, did I mess up. But really, I was very nervous. The shooting took about 10 minutes from the time I saw them to the time I fired. I could have waited longer, but I was anxious. I wanted to get it over with and then head home. After the shooting, I ran to my car and drove off quickly to a White Castle on Northern Boulevard, end quote. Years later, the Queens District Attorney would question David about his intentions that night. Question, did you intend to kill both the passenger and the driver? Answer, just the woman. I thought she was in the front seat passenger side. It was very dark. David had not intended to attack a man. He had no real issue with men. Women were the object of his rage. But still, he was curious to find out the quote-unquote result of his second attack. And the next day, after reading about the shooting in the paper, he became very upset on two separate points. The first was that the shooting was given less coverage than the final debate between Jimmy Carter and Gerald Ford. The second was that no one was killed.
I look back at it now and say I'm glad nobody was killed, but at that time I was angry because I saw that as failure, you know. I had so much rage that I had wanted to do that, you understand? And when I didn't, it was like I was frustrated in a way, but then I didn't go out immediately afterwards again, you know. I just... It released enough of my, just expressing my anger to them, you know, even if I didn't hurt them seriously, it was enough to just dispel anything that had built up. You know, it was sufficient. It wasn't so much their deaths, it was just the act. You know, it's, I wasn't so really disappointed that they, in a way I was, because it made me look like a failure, that I failed at doing it. But then in a way I was glad. In a way I found it satisfactory to just simply shoot the gun, even if I didn't hurt anybody too seriously. And they weren't hurt that seriously.
He did talk of the botched shootings, if you can call them that, the ones where no one died, as leaving him with a sense of failure. And that, of course, made him more angry and more depressed and more driven to go back out and try to do a clean kill next time.
David Berkowitz was upset that no one had been killed in what had been his second attempt at murder with the .44. But then, for David, failure was nothing new. By the way, what Berkowitz said about Carl and Rosemary not being, quote, hurt that seriously, wasn't true. Carl spent 3 weeks in the hospital, where he received a metal plate in his head. And I can only imagine the long-term effects the night's events had on both Rosemary and Carl alike over the following years, not just for them, but for their entire family. Act 3. You're supposed to hold a pistol with two hands. In his third attempt to rob an innocent of their life, David Berkowitz had failed. The first time he had quote-unquote failed was with a knife, which he had understood in some way. But now he had failed with the .44, the very thing that was supposed to guarantee his success. I mean, the whole point of committing the murders in the first place was that he was failing at life, and now he was failing at this. It was also his first failure at emulating his hero, Travis Bickle, from Taxi Driver. The first failure at doing the exact thing that, in his mind, was supposed to right all the previous failures of his entire life. And now that wasn't working. He was pissed. It's hard to think of David Berkowitz as a perfectionist, and he wasn't, but he was a narcissist, so that's a high bar to live up to.
Even though he wasn't driven to be an accomplished person, he was pretty much a minimalist in school and in the army and was capable of learning and doing basic things. He had a sense that he should be perfect in everything, and he could never achieve that due to his confusion and his clumsiness. And I'm sure that those played a big role in his murders and attempted murders also. He wanted to do things right, but he never really could in his relationships or attempts to talk to women or to even strike up friendships with men. He would always say the wrong thing or fail to show up, wear the wrong clothes. He was a guy with two left feet.
For some reason, I think David felt these traits wouldn't follow him into his crimes, that they would somehow miraculously check themselves at the door. But of course, they did not. If you don't face your problems, you find them everywhere. As weird as that is to say, in this particular context, it remains true. And in this case, it was, as it often is, for a particular reason. And it had to do with how he was holding the gun.
He wasn't firing it properly. Correct stances, two hands. And he was trying to be the cowboy. He was trying to look like the guys in the movies when they just shoot from the hip and let the gun do the work. There again, he's sloppy.
Despite receiving training from the U.S. Army in how to properly hold and operate a firearm, David Berkowitz, not surprisingly, wasn't doing it right. You're supposed to hold a pistol with two hands. One, the right, for most people, held out straight, holding the gun, finger on the trigger, a slight bend at the elbow, and the left, a more pronounced bend, bringing the gun back towards yourself, left hand over the right. With your weight over your hips, standing left foot forward and right foot back in a medium to wide stance, equally proportioned, like a boxer. All this is done to maintain balance and control, not just before you pull the trigger, but also during and after recoil. Of balance and control, David Berkowitz had none. He was nervous, full of emotional baggage, and on top of all that, he was not even subconsciously, but consciously living out a weird sort of cinematic macho daydream that he literally picked up from a movie. So of course he was holding the gun like a moron. Which really, in this instance, we can only thank him for. He was attempting, just as he had in the military, to be a kind of, quote, action movie type soldier, end quote. And so, due to all that, thankfully, he had missed the death shot, and in his mind, failed. And now, by his own tally, he was even more of a loser than he had been before, and that's saying something. But unfortunately, he didn't give up. He went out again almost immediately looking for more victims, his circle widening even more.
The sense of failure at not having killed at least one of the victims that he shot at was beginning to eat away at him, and he began going on even longer drives searching for just the right situation, ideally a dark-haired woman or women. Ideally, he told me that he would have found people having sex in a car.
Not only was David failing at emulating his hero, Travis Bickle, when it came to murder, he was also failing at emulating him even when it came to just driving a cab.
The taxi driver movie fantasy did not pan out in reality to be quite as glamorous as Robert De Niro had in the movie, after which he was trying to pattern himself as some sort of noble savage killer.
Turns out driving a taxi is hard work, and putting a lot of effort in isn't really David's style. He was looking for a cinematic escape from his life of endless toil, not a continuation of it. David Berkowitz wasn't having it.
Yeah, when you were a taxi driver, how many hours a day were you out there?
I worked about 10 hours a day.
I think that's why taxi drivers have short tempers.
All the traffic and the pressure, everybody's always in a hurry. Step on it, please. Come on, let's go, you know. Can't drive much faster, and then the cars are all beat up.
Long hours, boredom, driving, always had to be hoping for a fare, and he barely made enough money to pay his rent and feed himself during that time.
I had, when I got out of the service, I had about $8,000, but within a couple of years, it was all spent just on paying bills and things. And I didn't even have a chance to really use that for any luxuries for myself. $1,500 went towards the car, and there was about $6,500 left over. And that was just spent paying rent bills and stuff, because I wasn't making any real money. Just a little working all those, 10 hours a day driving a car, 6 days a week, and I was taking it home, like maybe $130, $135 with tips. It was very frustrating. And since I had no seniority in the company, you see, they didn't give me the good calls. Only the guys who have been there for like 5, 6 years driving the cabs, right? Or the older men who were in their 60s or 70s, they get the good calls, like somebody going from the Bronx to Kennedy Airport, which is it was an $18 trip. Plus the person gives $2 or $3. The only trips they got for me were these $2 trips, like somebody wanted to get the cab and go maybe 2 miles to the shopping center, you know what I mean? And he just never amounted to much, so I never made any money. It was just very frustrating.
Always the victim, David Berkowitz, while attempting to murder the innocent, still found time to complain about his job. Some things are universal, even for serial killers.
Reality was, he was assigned to drive the low-rent areas where people didn't have a lot of money and tended to be somewhat disturbed. His summary word for his passengers was nasty. It was a profound, unromantic disappointment to him.
So the taxi thing wasn't working out, and it was time, once again, to change occupations. It just so happened that around that time, just as he needed it to, an opportunity presented itself. Pearl's brother Harry got David a job as a sheet metal apprentice for $125 a week. It was an introductory position, of course, but it was a good job with a solid future. But still, David found a way to screw it up. Later, his foreman had this to say of him. Quote, quiet and a loner. I had no trouble with David, but he was just a body at a plant, not much of a worker. He didn't do good with tools. He was sometimes depressed and would break into tears, end quote. I don't think crying at work is much of a look today, I guess depending on who you do it in front of. But back in the 70s, to the guys down at the plant, I imagine it went over not at all. Although, it might not have shocked them too much because, strangely, David's adoptive uncle Harry, who had got him the job, was also a weirdo. Not surprisingly, David, most likely due to this, looked up to his uncle Harry. No doubt because David recognized Harry as quote-unquote emotionally troubled. David's uncle Harry was a loner and a recluse, a quote, quiet and mysterious man who never had a friend that anyone could recall, and would sometimes leave the house on long walks where he'd be gone for days, then mysteriously reappear. David would say later, quote, Harry died alone and was buried alone. He was friendless, end quote. Sound familiar? Although not a blood relation, there are obviously some similarities here. David felt an affinity, or perhaps a familiarity, for Harry. So David quit cab driving and found himself in a new job as a sheet metal worker's apprentice. But it wouldn't turn out to be everything he hoped for.
cab job lasted about 2.5 months or so. So I couldn't take that anymore. Then finally the sheet metal job came through. I had taken a test for that after I got out of the service. You had to go through a lot of testing and you have to know people in the union. But after I started the sheet metal job, it was the same thing. Although the working hours were better, it was a 40-hour work week, plus I had to go to training course on Saturday. Still, I was only making $125 a week, take home. And this was nothing.
What was the name of the sheet metal company?
Wolf, W-O-L-F-F, and Munier, M-U-N-I-E-R.
Is that a sheet metal company? Is that the way they describe themselves?
Wolf and Munier, Sheet Metal Works. They're in Elmsford, New York.
David Berkowitz had quit cabbing, but unfortunately he had not given up on killing, and it wasn't too long before he went out again looking to harm the innocent. Jack asks David, how soon after he viciously attacked Rosemary Keenan and Carl DeNiro did he go out again looking for someone to harm?
How soon after that did you go out again?
Well, I started going out within a few weeks after that, again, regularly, but crime didn't result until about a month after that, in November of 76.
Okay, what happened there?
Two women were shot in Floral Park, Queens.
Where?
Floral Park, Queens. F-L-O-R-A-L.
They were in a car again?
No, in front of a house.
How far is the car away?
About 2 blocks.
And this time, he would change MO again. I guess he wanted to make sure he wouldn't quote-unquote fail this time. Act 4. Donna DeMasi and Joanne Lomino. On November 22nd, 1976, just 5 days before David Berkowitz set out to murder two young ladies on their porch, he tried his hand at poetry, penning the following poem, which he titled Mother of Satan. Mother of Satan, old Mother Hubbard, sitting near the cupboard, with a hand grenade under the oatmeal. Who will you kill now, daughter of Satan? In the image of the Virgin Mary, pure and innocent, the great impersonator, is that you? Yes. How many have you deceived? Lured to slaughter like a fat cow. I don't even know where to start with this thing, so I'm just going to let it sit. But I will say that for those of you who are unaware, terrible poetry is yet another element of serial killer soup. Not really, but terrible poetry is pretty common amongst these guys. BTK, Israel Keyes, Paul Bernardo, etc., etc. Possibly a byproduct of the narcissism. I mean, if you consider yourself to be better than everyone else on nearly every level, then surely that includes poetry. I'll let you be the judge. At any rate, 5 days later, on November 27th, 1976, David Berkowitz parked his car in front of his own apartment building and thought to himself, tonight, quote, would be a night for hunting. Later that evening, when he left to go looking for someone to harm, he said the car, quote, started right up, almost as if it knew I'd be looking again, end quote. Of the incident itself, he said, quote, I saw them on the porch. I drove my car around the corner and parked it, and then got out, walked directly to the porch up the street and fired, end quote. Here's our series producer, Allison Baker.
It was the day after Thanksgiving, Friday, November 26th, 1976, and Donna DeMasi was in her bedroom doing homework. Donna lived with her parents and her brother in the affluent neighborhood of Floral Park, Queens. Tall and slim, with long brown hair, Donna was a popular senior at Martin Van Buren High School. As Donna lay on her bed, her homework sprawled out in front of her, the phone rang. It was her best friend, Joanne Lomino. Joanne had graduated the year before, and the pair had always been close. Joanne's family lived just a few blocks away. In her first months of adulthood, Joanne was living with her parents, trying to find a job as a secretary so she could get a place of her own. Even though Donna's plan had been to stay home and catch up on her studies, she excitedly closed her books and accepted Joanne's invitation to head into Manhattan for a movie and a bite to eat, something they often did on weekends. When the movie was over, the two girls headed back to the neighborhood. Donna had a 12:30 a.m. curfew. It was 11:45 p.m. when they stepped off the bus at the corner of Hillside and 262nd Street, just a block south of Joanne's house. As the girls walked towards Joanne's, Donna noticed a man standing by a lamppost eyeing them from across the street. He carefully followed their movements. As the girls passed, he began to follow them. Walking faster now, nervous of the man's intentions, the girls hurried through the dim streets, past parked cars and dark houses, counting the seconds until they arrived safely at Joanne's front porch at 8331 262nd Street. When they reached the house, the girls stood on the front steps while Joanne frantically searched for her keys. She believed the man was gone and they had safely made it home, but she wasn't taking any chances. All of a sudden, Joanne looked over her shoulder and there he was, standing on the grass right in front of them. "Excuse me," the man said as he walked towards them. "Do you know where?" He never finished his sentence. What happened next was a blinding flash of light and sound. The man pulled the gun from inside his jacket and began firing. Joanne turned away, screamed in terror as the first shot ripped through her lower back, instantly shattering her spine. Donna was shot at the base of her neck, right at the shoulder. Both girls collapsed off either side of the porch into the bushes. The gun rang out three more shots and the man ran off down 262nd Street. Joanne, wincing in pain, cried to her friend, but Donna was unable to reply. Jolted awake by the gunfire and subsequent screams they could have had no idea belonged to their own daughter and her best friend, the Lomino family jumped out of bed and hurried down the stairs towards the front door. Joanne's younger brother, Charles, was the first to make it outside, and when he got there, he came face to face with a horrific scene. Both his older sister and her best friend, Donna, were covered in blood and crying out in pain. Charles ran back inside the house and quickly dialed 911. When the police arrived, they found both girls conscious and able to speak. It had only been 2 minutes since they were mercilessly shot by an unknown assailant. Donna was lifted into a police car and taken to the Long Island Jewish Hospital, while Joanne was carefully placed into an ambulance by paramedics. Donna had suffered short-term injuries, and after 3 weeks in the hospital, she made a full recovery. Joanne's diagnosis would change the course of her life forever. Her spinal cord was damaged so severely, she was left a paraplegic, bound to a wheelchair for the rest of her days.
Quote, "I saw them standing with their friends and I parked. By the time I was able to get back and hide behind the lamppost, they started to walk. I followed. They saw me and walked faster. By the time I crossed the street and got to them, they'd gotten to one of the girls' houses. They knew I was behind them and they tried to get in the door. One of the girls was wearing a maxi coat and calf boots. The other, a white furry coat and jeans. She had blonde kind of hair. I started across the grass to them. Everything was going right. They were right in front of me. I didn't want them to get frightened, so I began to ask them for directions. All the while, I was getting closer. They turned back to the door for an instant, but it stayed locked. They turned their heads to me. I had the gun out and pointed it in their direction. Then I shot twice. They were both hit and fell on either side of the stoop," end quote. Later, in prison, David's psychiatrist questions him about that night. Question: "Where were the girls when you fired at them?" Answer: "They were face to face with me. They had gotten to the door, but it wouldn't open. They turned their heads to look at me, and I shot them." Question: "Did you intend to kill them?" Answer: "Yes." Jack asks David how he felt after the attack.
Do you recall any sensations of pleasure that came from your crimes?
No, they were not pleasurable. I felt, you know, this is an important thing for people to understand, that there was no pleasure out of the things. I felt like I was just simply so angry. I was doing it out of anger. You might say maybe there was a morbid satisfaction to a degree, because like I felt I was getting revenge on some imagined wrong or something, you see. But other than that, no, I didn't enjoy it, you know. I felt like this was what I had to do.
Mm-hmm. David says he felt no satisfaction from the murders, but as we have seen, he goes back and forth on this point. I don't think it's something he likes to admit. In my interview with Jack, I asked him if he thinks this break in MO was an attempt by Berkowitz to return to directly confronting his victims the way he had in his first attack when he stabbed Michelle Foreman, to confront the very people he was the most intimidated by, young women to whom he was attracted. Jack thought that was possible, but most likely it was something much more simple.
I think that's very likely a factor that he was trying to test whether he had some kind of breakthrough that he could actually confront up close and personal a victim. But I think also he might have been thinking that maybe the reason I missed is I was shooting through glass into vehicles, and that might have deflected the ballistics of my .44 caliber slug.
David Berkowitz just didn't want to miss. As demented as it was, he wanted to get back on the scoreboard, so to speak. David Berkowitz was playing a sick and twisted game where everything was backwards and upside down. But somehow, through all that, he was very practical. He wanted to rob others of their lives, but he didn't want to die himself. He didn't want to get hurt, either. Quote, "You asked me why I was so nervous when I did the first three shootings. I guess it was a case of me being fearful of capture. But I also realized that I was doing something that was not only illegal, but also dangerous. I, too, could have been killed or wounded. The possibility of an off-duty police officer or a patrol car passing through the vicinity when the shots were fired was also taken into consideration by me. So I guess I had a lot to fear." End quote.
The result was he again apparently fired very hastily, probably got nervous because he did look these girls in the face, and was probably shaking and shooting with one hand again. They were both badly wounded. You don't get shot point blank with a gun of that caliber and not suffer serious wounds. But he failed in his objective to kill them, and killing was important.
Jack asks David what he did just before and just after the attacks.
Would you drive by and see somebody sitting there and then go park and then come back?
Yeah.
You always ran back to the car?
Well, within a distance, not totally run right back to the car, but ran a half a block and then just walked at a brisk pace. And then when I got close to the car, like a half a block away, maybe 50 feet away, I just slowed down to a nonchalant walk and strolled over to my car, got in, and just simply drove off. Nothing to arouse any attention that something was going on by running full speed to the car and screeching off the tires or something, you know.
You approach this thing so carefully that you wouldn't have aroused any suspicions.
Yeah, that's true, yeah.
David Berkowitz had quote-unquote failed again, now for the second time in a row. He had committed four attacks, and only one of them resulted in a homicide, which was, of course, his objective. On the back of the most recent failed attempt, he again had switched MOs, and the new MO did not work. As a result, David Berkowitz's center of gravity, if you can call it that, broke, spinning him wildly like a top, wobbling farther and farther out of control.
It put him right back to the childhood feelings of anguish that he had that came from inside about not being able to do anything right because he wasn't perfect. He knew that he had basic intelligence and abilities, and he was totally lacking in social skills and driven inward from his earliest memories. And when you're so much focused on something going on inside your own head, particularly your own ego and your own confusion and needs, you're not going to watch out what's happening around you. You aren't going to be a careful person. You are going to stumble and fall and walk into the path of cars and things he described himself always doing as, you know, a clumsy kid. He was just a big clumsy guy after military and everything else. He hadn't moved an inch from the darkness that he nurtured within himself from his earliest childhood.
As a young man, just 23 years old, David Berkowitz wasn't any farther ahead in terms of dealing with his issues than he had been when he was a boy. In fact, he was farther behind. And to make matters much, much worse, he was now dragging others down with him. And he was doing it on purpose, methodically and repeatedly, in the most vicious way possible. Next time on Killer Tape, David's quote-unquote losing streak was quite unfortunately about to come to an abrupt end.
Fourth round.
That was in Forest Hills, Queens. This was in January of 1977. I had killed a woman, and her boyfriend was escaped injury, physical injury.
Thanks for listening to Killer Tape, the true crime podcast where killers and hardcore criminals tell their own story in their own words. Killer Tape is written and produced by me, documentary filmmaker Bill Badgley, as well as veteran prison reporter Jack Jones. Additional writing and producing by Allison Baker. Executive producers include Jared Gutstadt, Jimmy Jelinek, and Phil Alberstadt. Research assistants by Olivia Pepper. Transcription services provided by Laura Klein Shaw. Editing and sound design by Molasses Manifesto Productions. Original score by Ben Von Wildenhaus. Artwork by Mike Gabriel. Killer Tape is based on 19 hours of audio recorded with David Berkowitz inside Attica Prison in March of 1980 by veteran prison reporter Jack Jones. Additional resources for the series include Confessions of Son of Sam by David Abrahamson, M.D., and Son of Sam by Lawrence D. Klausner. Special thanks to Christian Bernhardt and Shelby Shankman at UTA. Stay safe out there.